So, let's end this morning session with the second talk of Rob. We'll speak about very good formulas for the Alexander polynomial.
Okay, so first of all, like yesterday, my talk follows the handout. The handout, more copies are here, and these are pages 2 and 3 of the packet that I gave you. And if you look at the top left over here, there is a URL, and if you go to that URL, you can get this packet in PDF, and you can also get the video of yesterday's talk and watch it. I'm sure you don't want to, but it's there. Also, today's talk will be there, hopefully. Now, as for the content, so it's the same subject as yesterday, except the very other end of it. So it will look completely different. Okay, so yesterday I, in complete abstract generality, I came to the conclusion that there is a certain invariant of four-dimensional things. And then I think Alexei asked me about this spinning map of three-dimensional things into four-dimensional things. So that invariant in particular is an invariant of three-dimensional things. And then today I will start from the most simple-minded reduction of that invariant to three-dimensional things. And it will be completely elementary. And it will be very good formulas for the Alexander polynomial. So that's the content of the talk. And then I'll build up towards the end of the talk when it's sketchy and nobody follows. I will build up back again towards the direction from which I started. So that's the plan. Okay, that's the handout again. And here's the theorem. Here are those formulas. Essentially, the formulas are do nothing and uninteresting things, and one big messy formula. Not too messy, it makes sense, but I will actually not tell you how it makes sense. I will only tell you what to do with it and how it generalizes. Okay?
Sorry, is Omega the notation for the URL?
What?
Omega.
No, this Omega is completely different. Omega there was blue, this is black.
I see.
Blue is the name.
Sorry.
Okay? Okay. But before the formulas, I have to introduce the context. So I will be talking about tangles. Tangles, for me, are not necessarily inside, you know, with an upside and a downside, an upper side and a lower side. They look like this. So basically, for example, that's a tangle. It has three components, the green component, the blue component, the red component. But the components are cut somewhere. And in fact, in my tangles today, I do not allow closed components. I can talk about closed components, but I don't want to do it today. Okay? So there are open tangles like this. On tangles, there are only two operations that I care about. Actually, a few more, but the two that I care about the most are the disjoint union, meaning if you have two tangles, T and S, you can place them side by side while making no connections. And in fact, side by side is kind of irrelevant. I mean, I could have put them one above the other just as well. Okay, while making no connections. So this is the disjoint union. And then the second operation is a unary operation, and I call it the stitching operation. So if you have a tangle T with, tangles will have components, so it will have a component A, and let's say the input for A is here, A comes in here and comes out here, and the dashed line here means that it sort of makes a mess inside T, but the connectivity is indicated by the dashed line. And then there is a component B, which enters here and exits here and in between does some mess. The stitching of A and B, while calling the result C, is the tangle that you get by stitching the end of A to the beginning of B and calling the resulting long strand. Now I have a tangle with fewer inputs and outputs but more mess, so I'll call the resulting long strand C. This is the stitching operation. and the stitching operation with these two operations. Even before that, let me say the stitching operation is meta-associative. So it doesn't make sense. It's not a binary operation, so it doesn't make sense to say it's associative, but it has some behavior that looks like associativity. Namely, if you stitch A and B, calling the result A, and then stitch A to C, call the result A, so overall you stitch A, B, and C together and call the result A, then that's the same as stitching B and C, calling the result B, stitching A to B, and calling the result A. So basically, you know, if you have a tangle that has in it three strands, A, B, and C, and I stitch A and B, and then I stitch B and C, then that's the same as first stitching here and then stitching there. That's all. Okay? By the way, my notation is, so...
This strand A, okay, for the stitching, strand A,
yeah,
goes somewhere and there's a lot of...
No, this is where it exits the tangle.
Yeah, but then you cut it to...
No, it exits where it outputs the tangle.
Where
it goes out, I connect it to the very beginning of B.
Okay. Very end.
Okay.
Yeah. A and B must be adjacent.
So A and B must be adjacent so far, but very quickly I will generalize to virtual tangles and then it will not matter anymore. Okay? Now,
the box on my right actually should be bigger, higher, and should contain the...
Yeah, no, this is the box of T, but the tangle written here, the full tangle is this whole thing here. Okay? You're right, yes. It depends what the box indicates. It indicates T. It doesn't indicate the entire result. Okay? Now, and just a comment about notation. So I don't like little circles for compositions because then you have to read backwards. So instead I use double slashes. So double slash just means composition going from left to right. So you read, you know, you compose the order of reading. That's all. Okay. So why do I like tangles? So first of all, they are finitely presented. So with these operations, every tangle in the world can be written using a single generator, in fact two, the overcrossing and the undercrossing. So, you know, if you want to write an arbitrary tangle, you take, you put crossings corresponding to what you want them to be, and some of them may be over and some of them may be under, and then you just stitch this to this, stitch this to this, stitch this to this, and you got the tangle you wanted. So clearly it's finitely generated. It's also finitely presented, namely finitely many generators, namely you can write the Rider Master 1, 2, 3 in this language, so it's finitely presented. So if you want to construct invariants, it's enough to construct them on the generators and to specify how they behave under the operations. And then if you want to verify that your invariants work, it's enough to check the relations. That's one reason to like them. The second reason is, basically, knots are too big. It's very hard to work with knots or links. But tangles are kind of halves of knots, and it's easier to work with them. So divide and conquer proofs and computations work. So if you want to compute a complicated knot invariant, say it takes a 2 to the n pieces of computation, units of computation, you cut it in two, each two has half the number of crossings, so you get 2 to the n over 2 on the left plus 2 to the n over 2 on the right, then you have to spend some energy stitching them together. But in principle, you could have saved a great deal. And there are wonderful examples where it does save a great deal. So it's lovely when you can extend invariants to tangles. It's much better. The third point is not too well known, so maybe I will tell you a little bit about it. The point is that once you extend to tangles and your invariants behave well under these two operations, disjoint union and stitching, then various properties of knots become algebraic. So for example, the property of being a ribbon knot. If you don't know what a ribbon knot, please tune out for 30 seconds and oh no more, 4 minutes, and then come back again. Okay, ribbon knots are those knots that bound a disk that has only this kind of intersections. This is just a reminder, okay? But if you haven't seen these pictures, please tune out for just a couple minutes. But allow me to state the following statement, okay? So here is a statement. Given a tangle T, okay? Here are two types of closures you can do to it. Closure number one, sorry, the tangle T has to have four strands, and they should be, well, with connectivity as shown by the dashed lines here. So closure number one is to stitch the first two and to stitch the last two, and then the resulting thing is still a tangle.
So they're ordered?
Yeah, they're ordered. My components are always even named, A, B, C, D. Okay? So I stitch the first two, I stitch the last two, and then this is a tangle with two components, and well, that's closure number one. Closure number two is you stitch component two and component three, but also one to two at the bottom, and three to four at the bottom. And the result now is a one-component tangle. A one-component tangle is just a long knot, so it's just a knot, okay? And then my claim is that a knot is ribbon, okay? A knot is ribbon if and only if there exists a tangle T such that its closure number one is trivial, and its closure number two is our knot. And sorry, I lied. But you have to generalize. Instead of having four strands, you do the same with six, with four or six or eight or any even number of strands. Okay? And if you want an example, I challenge you to prove this. It's not hard, but it's amusing. And if you want an example, consider this tangle. It's fun to check that if you close it at the top, you get the trivial thing. Basically, everything slides out. And if you close it between here and here at the top, and here and here and here and here at the bottom, you get that the trefoil connects up its mirror image, which is a ribbon knot. Okay? But anyway, why does it matter? Why should I care about this? Because if you have an invariant which is well behaved under these operations, which is somehow an homomorphism under these operations, under the stitching, then the invariant of any knot will be in the set of closures of values z, where z is the arbitrary value of a four tangle, or six or eight, whose first closure is equal to one. So this gives you an algebraic condition that ribbon knots have to satisfy. And this is obviously interesting for people who know about the ribbon slice conjecture and things you might want to do about it. Things like that are obviously interesting. Okay. Likewise, the genus and the crossing number are also algebraically defined properties. Okay, but all of this is general philosophy, and now let me tell you about my specific invariant, or the invariant that I want to talk about today. So the claim is that there exists an invariant gamma defined on pure framed S-component tangles. So S is a finite set. S component just means that the components are labeled by S. Pure means no closed components. Framed means the usual thing, so I don't model by Rademacher 1. The values of this invariant are in the following set. So first of all, I define RS to be the ring of rational functions in S variables. T sub A, where A belongs to S. So one variable, one T variable for each component. And then the invariant is valued in this ring times S by S matrices with entries in this ring. So the invariant is really an ordered pair, a scalar, comma, a matrix. Such that the invariant has the following behavior under disjoint union and stitching. And the behavior is, so let me just tell you how I write things. So if you have a tangle, I write the invariant of the tangle as, well, it's a matrix. This A here is a matrix. But the rows and the columns of the matrix should be labeled by the set S. So I will put the labels here and here. These are the labels of the row, of the rows and the columns. And then I have sort of a missing box at the top. That's where I'll put the scalar. So if the invariant of one tangle is this scalar and this matrix with these rows and columns labels, and the invariant of another tangle is this scalar and this matrix, then the invariant of the disjoint union will be you multiply the scalars and you take the block diagonal sum of the matrices. That's the trivial part. And now the hard part. Suppose you have a tangle that has components called A and B, and then many other components which I, in general, we call S. Then the invariant of such a tangle will look like a matrix like this, where the scalar part is called omega here. The entries of the matrix are, well, alpha is the AA entry, beta is the AB entry, theta is a whole row of entries, because S is sort of all remaining things. So this theta is really a row, and you can tell it's a row because it has a line in the middle. And epsilon likewise is the whole row corresponding to B, and it has a line in the middle. And phi is the remaining column, and psi is the remaining column, and log chi is a n minus 2 by n minus 2
so
matrix.
That was the real reason why you took psi.
Of course. This is the only reason why I chose those letters. Originally, I had an inferior choice. This is the superior one.
Gamma is not a good notation.
Gamma
is also the name of being there.
Ay, ay, ay. Yeah, well. Okay, you're right. Okay, anyway, the stitching operation acts as follows. Okay? So, if I want to stitch A and B getting the result C, then first of all, the result will have row and column A and B will go away, but instead I'll have a row C and a column C, because the components A and B disappeared and got replaced by C. S will stay in place. And the formula is given us here. Namely, first of all, I define mu to be 1 minus beta, 1 minus this entry. And then the scalar part will be mu times omega. And the matrix part will be as written here. And notice that everything has sort of the right dimensionality. So for example, here I have a big box matrix plus a row times a column, which is again a big box, divided by a scalar. Okay? So it's clear how to interpret these formulas. And finally,
a row times a column is a 1 by 1 matrix.
No.
Yes.
No, a row times, oops, maybe I should have done it psi times theta.
Yeah, probably.
Sorry, so do it the way that makes sense. But, okay. Yes?
So you require that mu is
invertible,
sorry?
Mu is invertible.
Divide by
So, so I should have added conditions. So the condition is that the matrix part, when you substitute, well, the easiest condition that works is that the matrix part, when you substitute all variables to be zero, first of all, the substitution makes sense. And secondly, when you substitute all the variables to be equal to zero, the matrix part is the identity. Yes, is the identity. And when you check it, you find that this means that mu is invertible and everything works. So I forgot to. But in practice, it will work for all the. Sorry, where all the variables go to one, not to zero. Sorry. Yes, you're right. Good point. And I didn't finish the description of this. The last point is that the ring changes when I change the set of components of the tangles. So the last operation that you should do is after you compute this, every place you see a TA or a TB, you replace it by TC, because those variables disappear and became this. And then finally, in order to completely specify the invariant, I need to tell you what is the value of on the generators. So I didn't really need to tell you the value on the empty strand, but I'm telling you nevertheless. And the more interesting is that if you have an overcrossing labeled A and B, or an undercrossing labeled A and B, but A is always the label of the upper strand, then the invariant should be a 2x2 matrix and a scalar. The scalar is 1, the matrix is written here. Now, the claim is that there exists a unique invariant. Uniqueness I've already proven. If there is an invariant, since I've specified what it is on the generators and I told you how it behaves under the operations, it's unique, it's defined. Maybe it's not well defined. Well definedness I'll mention in a minute. So, okay. Yes?
So just for the last generators, I mean the crossing?
Yeah.
So there's no TB.
No TB, indeed.
Doesn't it mean that in the long run you have less
no.
variables?
No. Well, okay. Yes, if a strand B is always below everything else, it will not be visible at the end. Okay, you can slide it away. It doesn't matter. Okay. Yes. The value of the unknown. No unknown, because I do not allow closed components. If you want to ask what is the value of the long unknown is this thing. And the value is, the scalar is 1, the matrix is 1. Okay? So a few comments before I start proving. Really, not quite proving, you'll see. Before I prove, I like to prove. So first of all, the matrix part of the invariant, not the scalar part, the matrix part is just a stitching formula for the Bureau the Gassner invariant, whatever it is, of pure tangles. And this has been studied by several groups before. So Ledimet, Kirk, Livingston Wang, and Simasoni Turayev. But I don't think they wrote the stitching formulas. They wrote the invariant and derived it in sort of complicated, or I don't know if complicated, but let's say in more words than this. But somehow the observation that all you really need is this formula, I did not see it elsewhere. A few more comments. So the scalar part, when restricted to long knots, is just Alexander polynomial. If you're talking about a link which is obtained as a closure of a tangle, then there is an easy formula to derive the multivariable Alexander polynomial. I should say that as a formula for the Alexander polynomial, it's an extremely fast algorithm. So basically, you know what, without, maybe I don't want to go into details because it's already 24 minutes in, but if you cut appropriately your knot into pieces and use these matrices, you can keep these matrices relatively small at all times. Now, the operations that appear here look like messy formulas, but if you think about them, they are only multiplying a row. The most complicated thing is to multiply a row by a column. These are very, very, very simple operations. So at the end, it becomes a very, very fast Alexander algorithm.
But what is dead prime?
What?
Dead prime
is you remove one row and one column.
I see.
Next, there are also formulas. Yes?
So you're basically never multiplying matrices.
I never multiply matrices, except these operations implement matrix multiplication. I mean, if you do these operations enough time, they also implement matrix multiplication. In you can so matrix.
No, this is just dot product.
Doing these operations repeatedly will eventually multiply matrices. So matrix multiplication is hidden here. Okay. Let me tell you the comment about this, and then repeat to that. But before that, so I should say that there are a few other operations on tangles. So if you have a tangle with several components, you can always delete one component. So I know how this acts. You can also reverse the orientation of one component, and I know how this acts. And finally, there is an operation for strand doubling. Right, if you have a strand in a tangle, you can always replace it by two parallel strands that do the same thing. I know how this acts. This is actually very non-trivial. This is, you know, strand doubling is like the co-product in a Hopf algebra, in a quantum group. It's where the non-triviality comes. So this one is non-trivial, but I know how to do it. Next, okay. So one lovely property of this computation is that every step along the computation is the invariant of something. So the more standard definitions of the Alexander polynomial involve, you take your knot, you construct a big matrix, and then it's a black box. You compute the determinant. You can either do it by doing exponentially many operations, like sum over permutations of something, or you can do row and column operations. If you do row and column operations, it's only n cubed operations, but the matrices you see along the way, when you do these operations, you get various messy matrices that are meaningless. They're not the invariant of anything, they're just random intermediate steps. Whereas, in this way of computing the Alexander polynomial, so you know, if again I had the Alexander polynomial, I wanted to compute the Alexander polynomial of some knot, then first I compute the invariant of this tangle. What I get is the invariant of this tangle. Then the next computation step will be to apply this stitching formula. After applying this formula, I get the invariant of an honest tangle. Then I'll do this stitching, and again, after doing this, I get the invariant of an honest stitching. So basically, you know, instead of crossing a long river by a huge jump, you cross it by, I'm basically giving you a stepping stones along the river, where every step is a meaningful thing. So this is useful for Polyak and Ohtsuki, who are trying to cross some creek here in Kyoto, but it's also useful say you're trying to do, sorry, I have to pay my tax to the categorification language. So I no longer work on categorification, but I still have to pay my taxes. So, if you want to categorify, if you want to find a knot homology, finding a knot homology for the Alexander polynomial as it stands is difficult because we don't, combinatorially at least, is difficult because we don't know what determinants, we don't know what to do with determinants, they're too complicated. But here I'm telling you about relatively simple-minded operations, and applying these operations at every step you get a tangle, you get the invariant of a tangle, so something that ought to be categorifiable. So, you know, if you are the government who collects the tax, you should be happy now. So, meaning if you're Aaron Lauda or...
So do you think that for Anna Prozansky, categorification is easier than, say, your picture or a topological picture?
Well, step by step,
which has these stones, like.
No, well, at least let's be optimistic. Let's be hopeful. There is a categorification of the Alexander polynomial. It involves analysis, or it involves. Grid diagrams, but sort of various not so geometric things. Okay? And let's be at least optimistic that if you have simple formulas that should be categorified or categorifiable, it will indeed lead to a reasonable categorification. Though I have to say that this is not my motivation. Okay? That's only the taxes. Anyway, finally, I should say that everything here extends. And in fact, it's more naturally defined on virtual tangles, or on W tangles, which is the quotient of virtual tangles. So basically, nowhere in this story I use the planarity of the tangle. This was an observation made before. People ask me, do I only stitch neighboring strands? Well, I don't have to. I can stitch any two strands. So the formulas make sense for virtual tangles as stated. And in fact, more naturally, because now you can stitch anything to anything. So that's good news. And finally, I want to say that everything about this invariant fits in one column. If you now look at the handout, I'm still on the first column. Okay? Including propaganda, you've heard of propaganda already, and the implementation. So here is the implementation. So I think I don't have time to tell you the key implementation trick, so I'll just show the program just to indicate that it fits in one column. I have to admit that the font is small. So this part of the program is totally uninteresting. It's only about formatting the output. Okay? The interesting part of the program is here, and you can tell that really what appears here is you sort of find out what alpha, beta, theta, all of these things are, and then you use the formula. I mean, everything else here is, and this is the value of the the cross, right? Yes. So this is really the entire program. If you go to this URL, you can find a Mathematica notebook in which this program fully appears. And then, to enter it into the computer, you have to hit enter. So I hit enter, and now I have the program in the computer, and I can start running it. First thing, I have to check meta-associativity. You see, without meta-associativity, even for a fixed tangle diagram, I don't know that the procedure is well-defined. Right? If I have a fixed tangle diagram, I want to know that it doesn't matter in which order I do the stitchings, so I have to check this meta-associativity. So I input a generic tangle to my computer, meaning a tangle with just the entries. The entries of the matrix are just symbolic, okay? And then I tell the computer to take this generic tangle and apply to it the stitching of 1 and 2 into 1, and then the stitching of 1 and 3 into 1, and I ask it if it's equal to the other stitching. I hit enter, and immediately the computer outputs true. Now, I could have, of course, cheated you, but I didn't. Okay? Next computation. So this is actually an example of divide and conquer. Suppose you wanted to prove Rademeister 3. Well, all you have to do is to check Rademeister 3 for the tangle. Right? So I look at the tangle on the left-hand side of Rademeister 3, the tangle here. Each one is made out of three crossings. So I give names to the strands at the crossings. So I take the first one. It's a minus crossing between 5 and 1. So this is a negative crossing between strands 5 and 1. I multiply it by a 6-2 negative crossing. So this is a 6-2 negative crossing, and so on. And then I tell the computer to stitch 1 and 4 to get 1, and call the output 1. So I stitch 1 and 4, this is making this connection. Then I stitch 2 and 5, so I'm making this connection, whatever. Then I do the same for the other side. And this time I didn't ask the computer to check if the two are equal, I asked the computer to print the two. So I hit enter and the computer prints the two and you can inspect them. The results are, as expected, matrices of rational functions and they are equal. So I've just proven Rademaster 3.
I'm sorry.
Yes.
Does the order of multiplication matter?
Here?
No, multiplications.
Oh, here?
Yeah.
No, this is the disjoint union. The multiplication here is just the disjoint union.
Yes.
Okay. And finally, suppose I wanted to compute the invariant of 817. What do I need to do? Well, I label the strands at each crossing with labels. Well, there are 8 crossings, so I need 16 labels. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. I did it in order, but that's just my choice. Up to 16. Then I type in each of the crossings. So each of the crossings. So I have a minus crossing between 1 and 2. No, between 12 and 1. Sorry. So I have a minus crossing between 12 and 1. Then I have a minus crossing between 2 and 7, and so on. And then I tell the computer, this I call gamma, and then I tell the computer to stitch 1 and k, calling the result 1, and do it repeatedly for k running from 2 to 16. So after I do all of this stitching, I just get the tangle shown here, namely the knot 817, stitch into one component called 1. Again, I hit enter and the result is written here. The matrix part is not interesting. The scalar part is indeed the Alexander polynomial. Okay.
So it doesn't depend on the reversal of orientation.
Or
not?
Yes, but that's non-trivial to show. But yeah. Yeah. Okay. Next. Okay, so now some weaknesses, sort of, I have to acknowledge weaknesses. So first of all, the formulas are non-linear, so there are some contexts where it's trouble. Maybe I'll not tell you where. And there is another sort of, you know, I use rational functions, but really, omega is only the denominators of the matrix. So if you take the matrix part and multiply it by omega, it will always be Laurent polynomials. But proving it, so even though the computation is extremely simple, the proof involves checking exponentially many conditions. So, again, I should not tell you why this is interesting, or not interesting, why this is a weakness, but because I really want to move on, but I've stated my weaknesses. Okay, now, I forgot to put my computer in power. Horrible. I hope it will... No, I have to... So, okay, I hope it will not crash. Anyway, so where is it coming from, this invariant? So it comes from four-dimensional geometry, which I discussed yesterday. So, four-dimensional topology. So, first of all, here is a space of things that can be knotted in R4. So these are simply knotted balloons and hoops. So balloons are S2s connected by a strand, by a line, to a base point, which I will usually call infinity, and often I will draw it at infinity. And hoops are S1s that are again connected by a string to the same base point. And KDH of H and T is the set of all simple embeddings of things like that into R4 or S4, it's the same, it doesn't matter which one. Now, what are simple embeddings? Simple embeddings are embeddings for which there is a projection into R3, for which the balloons intersect in only simple curves, so no triple points and no branch points. So that's a very restricted subset of the set of all two knots. Okay, but actually if you look at the examples from yesterday, they were examples of that. Okay. Here are a few more examples. So there is the unknotted hoop, it goes from minus infinity to infinity, the unknotted balloon, where it is blown up like yesterday, which is so just an unknotted balloon connected by a line to infinity. And then there are the two sort of hop flings, or maybe crossings, where you have a balloon which is penetrated by a hoop, we're in four dimensions, so this is non-singular, and the same thing with opposite signs. Okay? And then there is also a map from tangles into knotted balloons and hoops. And the map is a sense, it's more or less the map, more or less the map defined by Sato, and it's also more or less the map that I that implicitly appeared yesterday. So basically, each strand in the tangle becomes a pair, one balloon and one hoop, and the balloon and the hoop follow the trajectory of the strand when projected to the plane. Okay, so this strand becomes this balloon and hoop, except the balloon gets capped on one end and connected to infinity on the other hand. And the hoop gets connected to infinity on both ends. And what happens at the crossing is specified by the example. Okay, but it can be. This is a general thing. We do the same in each crossing. So this means that if ever I will find an invariant of knotted balloons and hoops, it will be automatically also an invariant of tangles, because I can map tangles to balloons and hoops. Now, what operations exist on balloons and hoops? So it's a bit like pi 1 and pi 2 of a topological space. So if you have a so balloons are like pi 2 and hoops are like pi 1. So if you have a KBH here, then one operation is to merge the two balloons by building tunnels as shown here. And this is like multiplication in pi 2. Another operation is to merge the two hoops by tracing the first and then tracing the second. And this is like multiplication in pi 1. Of course, except we're in R4. So this, and we're talking about embeddings, not about homotopy classes. So this is not multiplication of pi 1 and pi 2, but it's like. And finally, there is the action of pi 1 on pi 2. Namely, if you have a balloon, you can take its string and tie it along a hoop. Okay? And you know, one way to sort of, the reason this red heart balloon is here is because it sort of symbolizes two of the operations. Sort of the multiplication in pi 2 is really you take the two lobes of the balloon and you let one of them cover one of the original balloons and the other cover the other of the original balloon, and the action of pi 1 and pi 2 is what you do to this red heart balloon before you give it to your child, right? You tie the end, you tie the neck so that the air will not run out. Okay? Okay, then there is some definition of some linking number which enters into the invariant, but I think I don't have time, so I will skip it. And instead, I will tell you that there is an invariant of KBHs, which has, meaning knotted balloons and hoops, which is sort of in similar way, is valued in scalars times matrices, except the matrices now are T by H matrices, so they are rectangular matrices. The rows are labeled by the balloons, and their columns are labeled by the hoops. And it is, this invariant is defined by its values on the generators and by how it behaves under the operations. So this is the behavior under sort of pi 2 multiplication, this is the behavior under pi 1, and this is the behavior under the action of pi 1 on pi 2. And then you can check that the things that I called the generators before actually generate the space of all knotted balloons and hoops, and therefore specifying this completely specifies an invariant. And furthermore, when this invariant is evaluated on a tangle, using the map from tangles to balloons and loops, the claim is that it is essentially, up to some minor change of variable, it's the invariant of before. So the invariant of before really came from something four-dimensional, which I've just described. Now, those are weaknesses and I'll skip them, but I'll tell you now how it relates to yesterday. So, I've just described an algebraic structure, the set of all knotted balloons and loops with a number of operations. The moment you have an algebraic structure, the question automatically arises, does it have a homomorphic expansion? The answer is yes, there exists a unique homomorphic expansion for knotted balloons and loops with these operations. Alternatively, a unique universal homomorphic universal finite-type invariant, and the values of this invariant, or more precisely, the values of the logarithm of this invariant, is in the Frehley algebra on the balloons raised to the set of hoops multiplied by the set of cyclic words. Furthermore, this invariant is also completely computable by formulas that I did not include, but if you look at this paper, you will find, you know, if you click here on the PDF, you will find that the formulas are fully there. So, and here is a computation. So when you compute it for the Boronian link, you get these trees and these wings, okay? Now, so how does this relate to the more simple mind of before? So the claim is that there is some quotient of the Frehley algebra which collapses almost everything, and what remains is the invariant that I described before. So basically, if you take this general thing and kill almost everything, what remains is what I talked about before. I know I'm over time, so I'll just say in 1 minute, so far the story has been about simply knotted balloons and hoops, but there are indications from quantum field theory that everything extends, maybe with some limitations, to all two knots. But I don't know how to do it. So this is a problem for you, but of course I didn't even fully specify it. So I mean, it's a hard problem for people who have not seen the full specification. Here are the references, and here's the propaganda that I always end with. I have a question to you. Did I beat Aaron Lauda in speed? Okay.
Any question?
So does there exist a video of this lecture?
But it's still in the camera. It will be on the web soon. There is also, this is a repeat of a lecture I gave in Oberwolfach in an hour instead of 45 minutes. And the video from Oberwolfach is already on my website. Go to Dror Bar-Natan Talks and, yeah. Yes.
The problem about the two knots is that we don't know the relations.
The problem with two knots is there are multiple problems with the general case of two knots. Well, first of all, well, okay, I don't know the generators even. I don't have, okay, the algebraic structure, so these, this algebraic structure, where is it? Right, this algebraic structure extends to general two knots, but the things that I called the generators no longer generate. So these no longer generate. So that's one problem. Okay?
What are the relations?
Well, if I don't know the generators, I mean, I don't know what to say even about relations.
So you derive, in some sense, the algebraic part for the tangles from the mass, from the balloons, and
yes. Yes.
Why would it be more simpler or more natural to do the algebra for the hoops?
So the history is exactly the opposite. The history is it started from completely abstract algebra question, In fact, really, my personal history is that I was reading Alexeyev and Torossian, writing about Kashiwara and Verne, and it seemed very non-theoretical, their paper. So I started reading it more and more, and I found, well, first, that it relates to the types of knobs that appeared in my talk yesterday. Then I found, and I got this theorem that is stated there. Then I started trying to force myself to compute this invariant, and I started, well, if you compute it, you need generators and relations, and the generators and relations, you know, after a lot of thought, came out to be this. I mean, several years of thought. It's not, at the end it looks simple, but anyway. And then I needed examples, okay? How do you actually work with it? So I looked for the quotient that would kill almost everything without actually killing everything. And that is this quotient that, where is it? Here. You mod out by this, and almost everything dies, but not quite. And then, you know, the history is exactly the opposite. And again, I should emphasize that the end result, or good chunks of the end, several chunks of the end result are known before, including to people in the audience. So Vladimir over there, I hope you're not mad at me for repeating your work. Yes?
What software package do you use to view your PDF files?
If you click here, you will know.
Okay.
You know, I mean it. No, I don't mean it. I'm not online. Yes, sorry.
So, Drew, what happened to the associator?
The associator, let's say, okay. The associator is not needed in everything that I've done here, but a remnant of the associator, the value of the vertex. So the associator is a tetrahedron, and it has four vertices. And a remnant of the associator is the value of a single vertex. In ordinary knot theory, it doesn't make sense. Individual vertices don't make sense on their own. In this knot theory, the vertices make sense on their own. And a remnant of the associator is this value of the vertex. And a remnant of this, in this story, is in the formula for... where did I say it? For doubling. This formula for doubling. The formula for doubling uses the vertex. Somehow the vertex is the non-trivial part of the coproduct. I didn't write this formula. It's not a naive formula. You cannot guess it.
So let's see.
I should add that I'd be happy to discuss with anyone the remaining pages on my handout.